So, the life and work of Matthew Henry. Matthew Henry was born at Broad Oak, October the 18th, 1662, into the home of Philip and Catherine Henry. Broad Oak is on the very edge of northeastern Wales, almost adjacent to where the two English counties of Shropshire and Cheshire meet. Matthew had one brother, John, who died at the age of six, and four sisters, Sarah, Catherine, Eleanor, and Anne. Matthew's father, Philip, a Presbyterian minister, was from Flintshire in Wales, in an area that now belongs to the county of Wrexham. By the time Matthew was born, Philip was almost destitute economically and living temporarily in the Broad Oak farmhouse owned by his wife's parents. The reason for Philip Henry's near destitution was the infamous Great Ejection of August the 24th, 1662, when most of the Puritan-minded clergy had left the Anglican Church, both in England and Wales. In Wales, Philip's province of Anglicanism, some 130 men, Philip included, of course, went out of the established church into an unknown future. Philip Henry was a Presbyterian by conviction and felt he could no longer remain in the Anglican Church as it had been reconstituted with bishops by the new king, Charles II. How had this situation come about? Well, let's very briefly step back from Matthew Henry's birth in 1662 to see how his father had ended up living a near-destitute Presbyterian in that Broad Oak farmhouse. England, and indeed Wales, had experienced one of the greatest upheavals in their history in the period 1640 to 1660, the period of the Civil War and its aftermath. The conflict turned the world upside down, resulting in the overthrow both of the monarchy and the Anglican Church. Monarchy and church had been intertwined ever since the Reformation, when Henry VIII had broken with the papacy and put himself at the head of the Anglican Church. Now, the Civil War of the 1640s had both a political and a religious aspect. The critics of the then king, Charles I, opposed him on both political and religious grounds. They wanted not only a king more accountable to Parliament, but also a national church more thoroughly Protestant and reformed in worship and organisation. Those who desired this were nicknamed Puritans. So when actual civil war broke out between King Charles and his opponents, almost all of those with Puritan sympathies fought for Parliament against the king. As often happens in a civil conflict, positions became radicalised and the parliamentary army was soon dominated by, as it were, left-wing Puritans, who were ready to go the whole way in destroying rather than reforming the monarchy and the Anglican Church. This was what happened in 1649, when King Charles was publicly put to death by the victorious Puritan army of Oliver Cromwell. The monarchy was abolished, England and Wales became a republic, Anglicanism was outlawed. Cromwell's Puritan regime, however, was unable to survive his own death in 1658, and in 1660, the monarchy was restored in the person of Charles II, son of Charles I. Together with the monarchy, the Anglican Church also regained its power and status, governed by bishops appointed by the king. Now, Charles II and his Anglican supporters had expected the English and Welsh people to conform to the restored Church of England as the state religion. But a significant and fairly numerous minority refused. They were convinced that they could not, consistently with their consciences, participate in the Anglican system, and so they remained outside the national church. Now, they didn't all agree among themselves about what a church ought to be, but they were of one mind in rejecting Anglicanism. So there were Presbyterians, like Philip Henry, Congregationalists, or Independents, as they were then called, Baptists, both Calvinist and Arminian, and Quakers. These were now given the title Dissenters or Nonconformists, for their refusal to conform to the established church. They were made subject to many legal disadvantages, reduced to the level of second-class citizens, and indeed, more often than not, were forbidden to practice their faith. Many dissenters ended up in prison in very unhealthy conditions that jeopardized the lives of those locked up there. The most famous dissenting prisoner of conscience was, of course, John Bunyan, who wrote Pilgrim's Progress in Bedford Jail. Philip Henry, too, would be imprisoned. This then explains the near-destitute circumstances of Philip Henry at the time of his son's birth in October 1662. Philip had been ordained in 1657 within the broad-based national church set up by Oliver Cromwell. In Cromwell's church, Protestants of all sorts were welcome, as long as they disowned the old Anglican prayer book, symbol of loyalty to the outlawed monarchy. Now, however, in August 1662, Philip Henry had to leave the national church, which was once again Anglican and Episcopalian, controlled by the restored monarchy with the prayer book back in use. Philip was able to survive economically through the small family inheritance of his wife, and he ministered to the people of Broad Oak on that basis without being paid. 2 months after Philip's departure into the ecclesiastical wilderness, his more celebrated son Matthew was born at Broad Oak. Matthew's early life is little known apart from anecdotes. We do know that his father Philip dedicated an unusual amount of time and energy to Matthew's education. Philip expounded the Bible at family worship every day, and these expositions, we're told, made a profound impression on the young Matthew. When family worship was over, he would often retire to his bedroom to weep and pray, and it was with great difficulty that his parents could persuade him to come down and join in the family meal. We also know that he and his sisters held a special children's prayer meeting among themselves every Saturday afternoon. At the age of 6, Matthew acquired a private tutor, the 15-year-old William Turner. Over the next few years, several young scholars, one after another, took up this position. Philip Henry tutored them to prepare them for university, while the young scholar, in turn, tutored Matthew. The main subjects of education at this point for Matthew were Latin and Greek. He also picked up Hebrew. We know that Philip taught this to Matthew's sister, Sarah, 2 years younger than Matthew, using a textbook of Hebrew grammar that Philip himself had put together. This level of education for children may seem extraordinary to us, but it was not at all rare at that time for the young to be so learned. Isaac Watts, for instance, by the time he was 13, knew Latin, Greek, French, and Hebrew. We have a letter written by 9-year-old Matthew Henry to his father in 1671, when Philip was away in London, in which Matthew says, "Every day since you went, I have done my lesson, a side of Latin or Latin verses, and 2 verses in the Greek New Testament." 9-year-old Matthew couldn't realize it, of course, but the foundations were being laid for his future fame as a Bible commentator. Matthew himself went to London just before his 18th birthday to pursue further study under the tutorship of the Presbyterian preacher Thomas Doolittle at Islington. Doolittle ran an illegal academy to give university-level education to dissenters who were not prepared to study at the Anglican universities of Oxford and Cambridge. However, after only 2 months, Matthew became seriously ill and had to return to Broad Oak. His cousin Robert, who had also gone to the Islington Academy, died of the same illness at this very time. There seems to have been a local outbreak of fever in the area. Unlike Robert, Matthew recovered from his near-fatal illness. And a few years later, at the age of 22, we find him back in London. but this time studying law at Gray's Inn, one of the London inns of court. It wasn't unusual at that period for young men who had no intention of entering the legal profession to study at one of London's legal institutions in order to improve their education. Matthew, for example, not only studied law, but learned French by attending a language class for 3 months. He also went to the many and various theological meetings which the capital city hosted, where he heard debates on the great church issues of the day. One he mentions in particular was a debate on the relationship between faith and justification. Matthew conformed to the Church of England while in London, worshipping on Sundays at St. Andrew's Holborn, near Gray's Inn. Here, the preacher was the eminent Edward Stillingfleet. Stillingfleet was one of the large-minded, tolerant Anglican divines, sympathetic to Presbyterians, a very distinguished preacher and thinker who would become Bishop of Worcester in 1689. Matthew's conformity may have been dictated by prudence. This was a very dangerous time for dissenters. In the aftermath of the popular Protestant rebellion against the new Roman Catholic king, James II. The rebellion had taken place in the West Country, led by the Duke of Monmouth, and had been supported by many dissenters. The rebellion was crushed, and James took savage reprisals against any and all suspected of taking part, or even of showing mercy to fleeing rebels. Philip Henry was himself arrested and spent several weeks a prisoner in Chester Castle. King James also stepped up his policy of re-Catholicising the nation. Matthew at this time expressed great disenchantment with the world and its course. "The more I see of the world and the various affairs of the children of men in it, the more I see of the vanity of it, and the more I would fain have my heart taken off from it and fixed upon the invisible realities of the other world." However, Matthew's worshipping in an Anglican church in London also perhaps testified to his lifelong passion for unity among all Protestants. He was entirely free of any kind of religious bigotry or denominational partisanship. While unable himself, for conscience' sake, to be ordained in the Church of England, he always recognised that it contained some faithful believers and ministers. Wherever the gospel was truly preached, there Matthew acknowledged the presence of Christ. So he felt able to worship in a gospel-preaching Anglican congregation if need be, although as a Presbyterian he could not and would not accept ordination at the hands of an Anglican bishop. Well, Matthew kept up his studies at Gray's Inn until around halfway through 1687. He had, however, felt called to the preaching ministry ever since his childhood. This isn't surprising, really, given the nature of a child's life in the home of a man like Philip Henry, a home often frequented by ministers of the gospel. With Britain now in such a precarious political and spiritual condition in the wake of the Monmouth Rebellion and the king's determination to bring his kingdom back to the Roman Catholic faith, Matthew seems to have decided that now was the time to put aside other things. The hour had struck for him to devote himself full time to preaching the authentic gospel of Christ to a troubled land. So he took his leave of Gray's Inn and returned to Broad Oak. That summer of 1687, he was invited to preach to dissenting friends in a number of houses in the city of Chester. His preaching went down very well, so much so that one of the underground Presbyterian churches of Chester wanted Matthew to preach for them on a permanent basis as their minister. This was the church that met in the house of Anthony Henthorne, a sugar merchant. After due deliberation and consulting the advice of his father, Matthew accepted the call. We have Matthew's own meditations on his call to minister in this church. I think I can say with confidence that I do not design to take up the ministry as a trade to live by or to enrich myself out of the greediness of filthy lucre. No, I hope I aim at nothing but souls. And if I gain those, though I should lose all my worldly comforts by it, I shall reckon myself to have made a good bargain. I think I can say with as much assurance that my design is not to get myself a name amongst men, or to be talked of in the world as one that makes somewhat of a figure. No, that is a poor business. If I have but a good name with God, I think I have enough. Though among men I be reviled, and have my name trampled upon as mire in the streets. I prefer the good word of my master far before the good word of my fellow servants. I can appeal to God that I have no design in the least to maintain a party or to keep up any schismatic faction. My heart rises against the thoughts of it. I hate dividing principles and practices, and whatever others are, I am for peace and healing. And if my blood would be a sufficient balsam, I would gladly part with the last drop of it for the closing up of the bleeding wounds of differences that are amongst true Christians. Now, in keeping with the Presbyterian understanding of church government, Matthew applied to the leading Presbyterian clergy in London to sanction his ordination. At a secret meeting, owing to legal restrictions on dissenters, they examined him as to his fitness for the ministry, and he submitted a Latin thesis on the topic, "Are men justified by faith without the works of the law?" Finally, he was ordained by the laying on of hands with fasting and prayer. Strikingly, one of the ministers who ordained him was Richard Steele, who had officiated 3 decades previously at the ordination of Philip Henry. Matthew then returned to Chester and took up his ministry in June 1687. A mere month later, he married Catherine Hardware, the only daughter of Samuel Hardware. They'd become acquainted through the Hardware's son John, who had himself married a daughter of some close friends of the Henry family. Philip Henry wrote a poem for Matthew and Catherine, which included this advice on married life. "Love one another, pray oft together, and see you never both together angry be. If one speak fire, the other with water come. Is one provoked, be the other soft or dumb. Walk low, but aim high, spotless be your life. You are a minister and a minister's wife. Therefore, as beacons set upon a hill, to angels and to men, a spectacle." The marriage, while happy, endured only for 18 months. Catherine developed smallpox while pregnant and died soon after giving birth to a baby girl on the 14th of February, 1689. Matthew was grief-stricken, but his first words after recovering from his tears were, "I know nothing that could support me under such a loss as this, but the good hope that she is gone to heaven, and that in a little time I shall follow her thither." Matthew soon remarried in July 1690, this time to Mary Warburton. This marriage was to last for the rest of Matthew's life. Mary outlived him by 17 years, dying in August 1731 at the age of 62. Now, what were the worship services like in Matthew's congregation? The congregation gathered at 9 o'clock in the morning. The service usually began with the singing of the 100th psalm. Then, after a short prayer, Matthew expounded a chapter from the Old Testament. He began at Genesis and worked his way right through the Old Testament book by book. This was not the sermon. It was more in the nature of notes and comments on the chapter under consideration. After this came another psalm and a longer prayer. Next, he preached the sermon proper, which we are told was about an hour in length. Then came another prayer and another psalm, and then the congregation was dismissed with a blessing. The afternoon service was pretty much the same, except that Matthew expounded a chapter from the New Testament rather than the Old. On Thursday evenings, he gave a Bible lecture, which was attended not just by his own congregation, but by Anglicans too. On this Thursday lecture, his topic for 20 years was the questions of the Bible. He began with Genesis 3:9, "Adam, where art thou?" And he concluded, 20 years later, with Revelation 18:18, "What city is like unto this great city?" Among Matthew's regular Sunday preaching was a notable series on Ephesians 4, verse 22 following, "Put off the old man, put on the new," in which he preached on the following topics: put off pride and put on humility, put off passion and put on meekness, put off covetousness and put on contentment, put off contention and put on peaceableness, put off murmuring and put on patience, put off melancholy and put on cheerfulness, put off vanity and put on seriousness, put off uncleanness and put on chastity, put off drunkenness and put on temperance, put off deceitfulness and put on honesty, put off hatred and put on love, put off hypocrisy and put on sincerity, put off bad discourse and put on good discourse, put off bad company and put on good company, put off security and put on watchfulness, put off slothfulness and put on diligence, put off folly and put on prudence, put off fear and put on hope, put off a life of sense and put on a life of faith, and finally, put off self and put on Jesus Christ. Matthew's theology was generally reformed, that is, he was a Calvinist, but of a moderate variety. He was happy, for example, to see some kind of universal reference in the atonement. His comments on John 3:16 bear this out. Quote, "Herein God has commended his love to the world. God so loved the world, so really, so richly. Now his creatures shall see that he loves them and wishes them well. He so loved the world of fallen man, as he did not love that of fallen angels. Behold and wonder that the great God should love such a worthless world. Though many of the world of mankind perish, yet God's giving his only begotten Son was an instance of his love to the whole world, because through him there is a general offer of life and salvation made to all. So far God loved the apostate, lapsed world that he sent his Son with this fair proposal that whosoever believes in him, one or other, shall not perish." Well, the Chester congregation prospered and increased under Matthew's ministry. It became necessary to move to a new and larger place of worship in Crook Lane. Eventually, the number of members reached 350. A good proportion of these traced their conversion to Matthew's preaching and teaching. Matthew's pattern of life as a minister was dominated almost exclusively by private study. He would get up early and usually be in his study by 5 o'clock a.m. at the latest. And there he remained, often till 4 in the afternoon. The only break he allowed was an hour for breakfast and morning worship. We're told that nothing was more irritating to him than if anyone interrupted his study time. He insisted that it was a sacred and necessary time in which he filled his mind and heart with the Word of God. The congregation received the benefit on Sundays and Thursdays. In Matthew's own words, "I am always best when alone. No place is like my own study, no company like good books, especially the Book of God." Now, in case we think Matthew was showing himself unusually antisocial here, he wasn't. This basically private lifestyle was not uncommon among dissenting ministers. In 1696, Philip Henry, Matthew's beloved father, died. He had lived long enough to see Britain delivered from King James II and his attempt to re-Catholicize the kingdom. James had been driven out and replaced by the Dutch Calvinist William of Orange in 1689. With William came toleration for dissenters. And Philip had lived to see his son enter the ministry and preside over a flourishing Presbyterian congregation of his own. Their farewell is quite affecting. A bedridden Philip greeted Matthew with the words, "O son, you are welcome to a dying father. I am now ready to be offered, and the time of my departure is at hand." He said he felt as though he were on fire, but thanked God that it was not the fire of hell. Then again to Matthew he said, "Son, the Lord bless you, and grant that you may do worthily in your generation and be more serviceable to the church of God than I have been." Matthew's last words to his father were, "O sir, pray for me, that I may but tread in your steps." Philip responded, "Yea, follow peace and holiness, and let them say what they will." His final words were, "O death, where is thy..." But before he could complete the sentence, he had departed this life into the next. Matthew was emotionally prostrated by Philip's death. And now what is this that God hath done to us? The thing itself and the suddenness of it are very affecting. The Lord calls my sins to remembrance this day, that I have not profited by him while he was with us, as I should have done. This should bring me nearer to God and make me live more upon him who is the fountain of living waters. My dear father was a counselor to me, but Christ is the wonderful counselor. My father was an intercessor for me, but Christ is an intercessor that lives forever and is therefore able to save to the uttermost. The new century, the 18th, brought Matthew Henry a more nationwide concern. He sensed that the spiritual fire in English and Welsh Christianity was burning low, and he particularly sensed it among dissenters. He remarked, "The low condition of the Church of God ought to be greatly lamented, the Protestant interest small, very small, a decay of piety, attempts for reformation ineffectual. Help, Lord! There are but few who are truly religious, who believe the report of the gospel, and who are willing to take the pains and run the hazards of religion. Many make a fair show in the flesh, but few only walk closely with God. Where is he that engageth his heart, or that stirs up himself to take hold of his Maker?" Henry had his own taste of this decline of vital godliness in his own congregation. One of its warmest members and supporters had been the wealthy merchant George Mannering and his wife. But they'd stopped coming to the worship, and Mrs. Mannering now became very critical of her ex-minister. As Philip Eveson comments in his biography of Henry, "The temptation for ministers to give up their preaching and pastoral work can be very strong, especially when people of promise disappoint, church discipline proves futile to reclaim them, and they become mouthpieces of Satan." Henry himself, obviously depressed, quoted Isaiah 49, verse 4. "Then said I have labored in vain and spent my strength for naught." Adding, "These things are a temptation to me to lay aside the pastoral charge. But I dare not, I cannot do it." Henry encountered further trials through his involvement in efforts at uniting dissenters, in particular Presbyterians and Congregationalists. He was always a keen supporter of Protestant unity, and the unity of dissenters was especially close to his heart. Perhaps the leading figure in these efforts at closer fellowship and cooperation among dissenters was the illustrious Puritan John Howe, a Presbyterian and in fact one-time chaplain of Oliver Cromwell. Under Howe's impetus, a doctrinal platform of union, known as the Heads of Agreement, was signed by nearly all the Presbyterian and Congregational ministers of London in 1691. It was more popularly known as the Happy Union. Presbyterian and Congregational ministers throughout the rest of England and Wales were urged to embrace the Happy Union. Those in Henry's county of Cheshire did so. As a result, Presbyterian and Congregational ministers in Cheshire now met together twice a year in May and August. At these meetings, they would engage in joint prayer, hear the word preached, share experiences about pastoral issues in their churches, and offer help and advice to ministers who were considering a move to another congregation. The Happy Union, however, soon found itself in severe difficulty, owing to a no-holds-barred doctrinal controversy between two Welsh ministers. One was the Presbyterian Daniel Williams of Wrexham, who was now the minister of Hand Alley Church in London. The other was Richard Davis, a fervent preacher from South Wales who'd become the pastor of a congregational church at Rothwell in Northamptonshire. Williams accused Davis of antinomianism, the view that the moral law, as summarised in the Ten Commandments, is not a rule of life to the justified believer. This accusation divided congregationalists. Some felt that Davis had fallen into this error, at least in some measure. But others rejected the accusation and gave strong support to Davis. Consequently, Presbyterians began condemning Congregationalists as antinomian, while Congregationalists began condemning Presbyterians as Arminian. The upshot was the destruction of the Happy Union in 1693. It had lasted 2 years. The Happy Union's unhappy demise touched Henry personally. In nearby Wrexham, the birthplace of Daniel Williams, all the Presbyterians withdrew from the Union. Local circumstances were such that this actually left them without a building in which to meet for worship. The national and local disruption of the Happy Union was a bitter blow to Henry's cherished ideals of Protestant unity. But he sided with the anti-union Presbyterians of Wrexham, thinking them in the right in their doctrinal quarrel with the Congregationalists. In the absence of a minister of their own, he gave them pastoral support. In 1700, or thereabouts, Daniel Williams donated a substantial financial gift, enabling Wrexham's Presbyterians to build a chapel. Matthew was one of the trustees. Thereafter, he preached for them as often as twice a month. Henry's ministry in Chester saw him exercising a pastoral care over many congregations in Cheshire and Shropshire, and also across the English-Welsh border at Broadoak and Wrexham. He preached for them, he conducted the Lord's Supper for them. Less frequently, he would go further afield and preach in places like Newcastle-under-Lyme, Manchester, Bolton and Liverpool. In addition to his local church ministry, Henry also often preached to the prisoners in Chester Castle. The jailer's wife was a devout Christian and seems to have asked Henry to undertake this prison ministry. So, for close to 20 years, he visited the prison and sought to proclaim the good news of Christ to men who, he himself says, appeared to be so hardened in sin that they had no concern for their souls, even when under sentence of death. To quote Henry, "Their peace is like the sleep of a man in a lethargy. It is not peace, but senselessness and stupidity. They love darkness and sit in it. My heart bleeds for them." Well, Henry continued as the minister of the Chester Presbyterian congregation for 25 years, until 1712. He then accepted a call from the Presbyterian congregation in Hackney, northeast London. Now, the Hackney congregation had already called him once before, in 1699, at which time Henry had declined. This time, after repeated urging from a unanimous Hackney church, he finally gave in. Many of the Presbyterian ministers of London had joined in the pleas of the Hackney congregation, advising Henry that he was limiting his usefulness by remaining in a relatively out-of-the-way place like Chester. The greater needs of London required his talents. This weighed heavily with Henry. One of the chief reasons he gave for accepting the call was as follows. There is manifestly a much wider door of opportunity to do good opened to me at London than is at Chester, in respect to the frequency and variety of weekday occasions of preaching and the great numbers of the auditors. The prospect I have of improving these opportunities and of doing good to souls thereby is, I confess, the main inducement to me to think of removing thither. He also admitted that he felt discouraged by the work in Chester and wondered whether a new minister might be able more effectively to take it up. Perhaps he felt stale after 25 years there in the same place. When Henry made his decision known to his Chester congregation, it produced a very divided response. Some understood his reasons and motives for leaving them and continued to love and support him. Others, however, were shocked and angry and began treating him with open contempt and disrespect. Some of those who now turned against him had been his warmest friends and supporters. Henry was staggered and, as Philip Eveson notes, needed a great deal of wisdom and grace to act with a meek spirit and keep his own emotions under control. Henry took up his new position in Hackney in May 1712. He was certainly much busier in London than he had been in Chester. He had 3 regular Sunday services in his own church. He often gave an early Sunday morning Bible exposition at Little St. Helens, where a Presbyterian church had met since 1672. Sometimes, after his own Sunday services, he went to other London congregations to give evening expositions. During the week, he often preached 2 or 3 times a day in and around the capital city. The extent of his activities is astounding. He also devoted himself to instructing young people. Sunday schools had not yet been invented, and the ordinary method of teaching the young at that time was the catechism. So Henry catechized his young people every Saturday. He also gave a regular public lecture on the catechism. This aspect of his work was very successful. Some youngsters were spiritually awakened, and a revival of catechizing spread through the London churches. Henry's ministry in London also coincided with an attempt by the then government to clamp down tight on the civil rights of dissenters. The governing party at that time was the Tories, who were somewhat intolerant zealots for the Church of England. Just before Henry arrived in London, they had pushed through the Occasional Conformity Act in 1711. It prevented non-Anglicans from taking occasional communion in the national church in order to qualify for public office. More seriously, in 1714, the Tory government initiated a new measure, the Schism Act, which aimed at prohibiting all non-Anglicans from educating their own children in their own schools. The dissenting community was alarmed and outraged. Henry himself went into print against the intolerant measure with a pamphlet entitled Serious Thoughts About the Bill Brought into the House of Commons Against Dissenters' Schools and Academies. In May 1714, together with other representatives of dissent, Henry appeared in court to lodge a protest and appeal against what he called this wicked bill of persecution. London dissenters held a special day of prayer against the Schism Act, where Henry preached a sermon from 2 Chronicles chapter 20, verse 12. O our God, wilt thou not judge them? For we have no might against this great company that cometh against us, neither know we what to do, but our eyes are upon thee. Thankfully, the very day the Schism Act was due to come into effect, the then monarch, Queen Anne, died, and the act was never enforced. The Whig Party came into power under the new monarch, George I, and the Whigs, ancestors of the Liberal Party, were the political champions of the dissenters. They remained in power for the next 45 years, so dissenters could breathe freely again. Before Queen Anne died, however, Henry himself had passed from his labours to his rest. When he left his congregation in Chester in 1712, he had promised to visit them once a year. In May 1714, in fulfilment of his promise, he once again left Hackney and travelled north. After preaching at Chester several times, he set out on Monday, June the 21st, on his return journey to London. En route, he had a preaching engagement at Nantwich. Before arriving, he had an accident, falling off his horse. He claimed he had not been hurt, but when he preached, everyone noticed that he was not so animated as usual. He was short of breath, and afterwards very tired. Henry now became too ill to continue his journey, so he was taken to the home of the Nantwich church's minister, Joseph Mottershead. He had a restless night, and in accordance with the medical practice of the day, a physician drained off some of his blood. At about 5 o'clock in the morning, he had a stroke that left him without the power of speech. He died some 3 hours later, on Tuesday morning, the 22nd of June, 1714. He was 51 years old. On the following day, his eldest sister, Sarah, has this entry in her journal. Wednesday, June the 23rd, I went to the place to take leave of the dear earthen vessel in which was lodged such a treasure, and shall always remember there was nothing of death to be seen in his face, but rather something of a smile. How is the gold become dim, and the fine gold changed? That head, that hand, so fitted for service, now cold and motionless. Lord, what is man, the greatest, the best? On Thursday, John Reynolds, a Presbyterian minister from Shrewsbury, preached at the Nantwich Chapel on the text, Well done, good and faithful servant. On Friday, Henry's body was taken to Chester for burial at Trinity Parish Church in Watergate Street. Dissenting ministers and people throughout England and Wales lamented the passing of a faithful man of God. A granite monument with a bronze portrait dedicated to the memory of Matthew Henry was unveiled in August 1860 in the churchyard of St. Bridget's Church, Chester. Today, the monument stands in the centre of the Grosvenor roundabout, facing the Crown Court and the castle. Little or nothing seems to be known of how Henry's wife Mary was impacted by her husband's death, but she was left with a large young family to care for. The two eldest daughters, Catherine and Esther, were already young women, but Philip, Henry's only son, was 14, Elizabeth 12, Sarah 10, Theodosia 6, and Mary 3. Mary Henry died in August 1731, aged 62. What shall we say then about Matthew Henry's personality and achievements? His personality first. We can gather some insight into his mind and heart from his journal. So here are a few select entries. July the 1st, 1696. There are some things I would more particularly engage myself to upon this providence, his father's death. One, to be more grave and serious. Two, to be more meek and humble, cautious and candid, because these were the graces that my dear father was eminent for, and God owned him in them, and many honoured him for them. I'm aware of too much hastiness of spirit. I would learn to be of a cool, mild spirit. 3, to be more diligent and industrious in improving my time, for I see it is hasting off apace, and I desire to have it filled up, because I see I must shortly put off this my tabernacle, and there's no working in the grave. December the 31st, 1703. I have oft bewailed my barrenness in the art of good conversation with others, and unskillfulness in beginning it, and coldness of concern for the souls of others. And on reflection, on this year, I find it has not been much better. I bless God, I love good conversation, and would promote it, but I lack zeal. January the 1st, 1705. Lord grant that this year I may be more holy and walk more closely than ever in all holy conduct. I earnestly desire to be filled with holy thoughts, to be carried out in holy affections, determined by holy aims and intentions, and governed in all my words and actions by holy principles. Oh, that a golden thread of holiness may run through the whole web of this year. And finally, March the 8th, 1713. London. I preached Mr. Rosewell's evening lecture, Psalm 89, verse 16, The Joyful Sound. As I came home, I was robbed. The thieves took from me about 10 or 11 shillings. My remarks upon it were, 1, what reason have I to be thankful to God, who have travelled so much and yet was never robbed before? 2, what a deal of evil the love of money is the root of, that 4 men would venture their lives and souls for about half a crown apiece. 3, see the power of Satan in the children of disobedience. 4, see the vanity of worldly wealth, how soon we may be stripped of it, how loose, therefore, we should sit to it. Now that brings us on to consider Matthew Henry, the public author, the capacity in which he is remembered today. Being dead, he yet speaks through his writings. So let's look at Henry the author. He first ventured into print in 1690 with a brief inquiry into the true nature of schism, in which he defended dissenters from the accusation of having committed the sin of schism, violating the unity of the body of Christ in leaving the Church of England. In 1694, he brought out a collection of family hymns from various authors, including a short essay on psalmody. Henry was one of the early Reformed advocates of hymn singing in worship. He said, "We must sing a new song, newly composed upon every special occasion, a new song for new mercies, and upon every new occasion for those compassions which are new every morning. A new song is a New Testament song, a song of praise for the new covenant and the precious privileges of that covenant." The first work of Henry's that made a big impact was a biography of his father, Philip, which came out in 1698. Now that's still available, or at least it was until recently, from the Banner of Truth. Then followed a scripture catechism in 1702, which was later translated into Welsh, and a plain catechism for children in 1703. A work that was to gain a wide readership was The Communicant's Companion, a manual on how to prepare for and take part in Holy Communion, the Lord's Supper. In 1710 came another work that proved very popular, and has often been reissued, A Method for Prayer, with scripture expressions proper to be used under each head. In 1712, his Directions for Daily Communion with God was published, again often reprinted. And then finally, we have a newly discovered set of 29 sermons by Henry, published for the first time in 2002, under the title Sermons of Matthew Henry on the Covenant of Grace. Now, of these treatises, the method for prayer has perhaps been most frequently reprinted and recommended. Let's just have a little look at it. Henry divides prayer into five branches: adoration, confession, petition, thanksgiving, and intercession. He explains each branch and offers various examples of prayers that express each of them. These prayers are drawn largely from the Bible itself. For example, when expounding the meaning of thanksgiving, he says this: "Our errand at the throne of grace is not only to seek the favour of God, but to ascribe to him the glory due his name, and that not only by a reverential adoration of his infinite perfections, but by a grateful acknowledgement of his goodness to us, which cannot indeed add anything to his glory, but he is pleased to accept of it and to reckon himself glorified by it, if it comes from a heart that is humbly conscious of its own unworthiness to receive any favour from God, that values the gifts and loves the giver of them." He then offers these as examples of thanksgiving prayers: "Let our souls bless the Lord, and let all that is within us bless his holy name. Yea, let our souls bless the Lord and forget not all his benefits." Psalm 103. "We will praise the Lord, for it is good, it is pleasant, and praise becometh the upright. Yea, it is good to give thanks unto the Lord, to sing praises to thy name, O Most High, to declare thy steadfast love in the morning and thy faithfulness by night." Psalm 92 and Psalm 33. "We will extol thee, our God and King, and bless thy name forever and ever. Every day we will bless thee and praise thy name forever and ever. We will pour forth the fame of thy abundant goodness and sing aloud of thy righteousness." Psalm 145. Now, when we read the amazingly rich abundance of prayers that Henry draws out of the scriptures, we find we have words for every occasion and no reason ever to be silent. The modern American admirer and promoter of Henry, Lig Duncan, says of this treatise that it will, among other things, do the following for us: teach us the extreme urgency of prayer, correct shopping list views of prayer that abound in the Christian community, force us to rehearse the solemn warnings and precious promises of God, and return proportion to prayers long on petition but short on adoration, confession, and thanksgiving. The treatise also includes an exposition of the Lord's Prayer, which Henry prefaces thus: "The Lord's Prayer being intended not only for a form of prayer itself, but a rule of direction, a plan or model in little, by which we may frame our prayers, and the expressions being remarkably concise and yet vastly comprehensive, it will be of good use sometimes to lay it before us, and, observing the method and order of it, to dilate upon the several passages and petitions of it, that we may use it the more intelligently." But it was in the early 1700s that Henry began writing his most famous and enduring work, his commentary on the whole Bible. It began as a commentary on the Old Testament alone, intended to stand alongside an existing and highly esteemed commentary on the whole New Testament by William Burkett, an evangelical Anglican minister, vicar of Dedham in Essex, and close friend of the more famous William Gurnall, author of The Christian in Complete Armour. Burkett's New Testament commentary came out in two volumes in 1700 and 1703. Henry was urged by various friends to undertake this project of adding an Old Testament companion to Burkett's New Testament tome. He took it up, and volumes of Old Testament commentary began to flow from Henry's pen. His journal describes the beginning of the enterprise. "November the 12th, 1704. This night, after many thoughts of heart and many prayers concerning it, I began my notes on the Old Testament. It is not likely I shall live to finish it, or if I should, that it should be of public service, for I am not equal to the undertaking. Yet in the strength of God, and I hope with a single eye to his glory, I set about it, that I may endeavour something, and spend my time to some good purpose, and let the Lord make what use he pleaseth of me. I go about it with fear and trembling, lest I exercise myself in things too high for me. The Lord help me to set about it with great humility. Henry's commentary on the first five books of Moses was published in 1706. Joshua to Esther in 1708. Job to the Song of Solomon in 1710. And the rest of the Old Testament in 1712. Once he'd finished the Old Testament, he decided to press on with a New Testament commentary of his own. He died in 1714 before any of it could be published. But he had fully written up a commentary on the four Gospels and the Acts of the Apostles. This was finally published in 1721. What of the rest of the New Testament? Does Matthew Henry's commentary not cover the whole of it? Well, in one sense, no. In another, yes. Henry's friends and admirers completed his commentary, basing themselves on Henry's notes on the relevant portions of Scripture as he had preached his way through them. So from Romans to Revelation, the essential content derives from Henry, but it's been written out in full by others. Now, Henry made it clear that his commentary was basically practical and devotional in nature, aimed not at minute examinations of the Hebrew and Greek text, but rather at applying its message so as to kindle faith and holiness in the heart of the reader. If readers wanted a detailed textual commentary, Henry advised them to read the masterly work of the eminent Puritan scholar Matthew Poole. Poole's commentary on the Bible is indeed the perfect companion to Henry's. Superb scholarship in the one, wholesome practical spirituality in the other. Since its publication, Henry's commentary has earned a lofty place in the affections of Bible students. Among others who have prized it are George Whitfield, John Ryland, Thomas Chalmers, C.H. Spurgeon, and Arthur Pink. Spurgeon, in his Commenting and Commentaries, places Henry at the top of his list of Bible commentaries, the indisputable number one. I quote, "First among the mighty, for general usefulness, we are bound to mention the man whose name is a household word, Matthew Henry. He is most pious and pithy, sound and sensible, suggestive and sober, terse and trustworthy. You will find him to be glittering with metaphors, rich in analogies, overflowing with illustrations, superabundant in reflections. He delights in apposition and alliteration. He is usually plain, quaint, and full of pith. He sees right through a text directly. Apparently, he is not critical, but he quietly gives the result of an accurate critical knowledge of the original right up to the best critics of his time. He is deeply spiritual, heavenly, and profitable, finding good matter in every text, and from all, deducing most practical and judicious lessons. His is a kind of commentary to be placed where I saw it, in the old meeting house at Chester, chained in the vestry for anybody and everybody to read. It is the poor man's commentary, the old Christian's companion, suitable to everybody, instructive to all." And if I can add my own testimony, there are three writers who commented on all or most of the Bible whom I habitually consult: John Calvin, Matthew Henry, and John Gill. Of the three, Henry is usually the best at providing practical material, and I often quote him in my sermons. When a believer wants general help in studying the Scriptures, I always advise them, first and foremost, to go and make use of Matthew Henry. Let's close the lecture first with a few choice quotes from Henry, who is always very quotable. "The anger of a meek man is like fire struck out of steel, hard to be got out, and when got out, soon gone. It is not talking, but walking that will bring us to heaven. What think we of Christ? Is he altogether glorious in our eyes and precious to our hearts? May Christ be our joy, our confidence, our all. By the light of nature, we see God as a God above us. By the light of the law, we see him as a God against us. But by the light of the gospel, we see him as Emmanuel, God with us. Extraordinary afflictions are not always the punishment of extraordinary sins, but sometimes the trial of extraordinary graces. Sanctified afflictions are spiritual promotions. He whose head is in heaven need not fear to put his feet into the grave. Those who complain most are most to be complained of. When passion is on the throne, reason is out of doors. None can know their election but by their conformity to Christ. For all who are chosen to sanctification. Come and see the victories of the cross. Christ's wounds are thy healings, his agonies thy repose, his conflicts thy conquests, his groans thy songs, his pains thine ease, his shame thy glory, his death thy life, his sufferings thy salvation. Nothing exposes religion more to the reproach of its enemies than the worldliness and hard-heartedness of its friends. And finally, a quote from Philip Evesen from his biography of Henry. Matthew Henry died, aged 51, greatly respected during his life for his preaching, wise counsel, and published works. Since then, his catechism and advice on prayer, as well as his popular commentary, have been a source of spiritual nourishment to many. Indeed, the name of Matthew Henry will always be associated with his famous commentary. All over the world, there are Christians who still appreciate the value of his work. For 300 years, his exposition of the biblical text, devotional comments, practical wisdom, warm theology, and helpful insights have been of immense value to Christians both in their private devotions and family worship. Preachers and teachers of God's word have also found his work a useful tool in the preparation of their sermons and scripture lessons. And then, this is final, if anyone wants to pursue some further studies of Matthew Henry, two modern biographies came out in the year 2012. So that's Philip Evesen's biography of Matthew Henry. That's in a series called Bite-Sized Biographies. And then in the same year, 2012, an American book, Alan Harmon's book, Matthew Henry, His Life and Influence. And that's also 2012. And then behind them stands the old classic, J.B. Williams, The Life of Matthew Henry, published back in 1828. So I'll just pause for a glass of water at that point. I'll come down and there's an opportunity for questions.